by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour of the show, we will get an update on what many people consider to be the biggest corporate health scandal in U.S. history, asbestos. And our guest is journalist Andrew Schneider. He is the co-author of a book that was published last year. In fact, we talked about it when the book was relatively new. The title is An Air That Kills, the subtitle How the Asbestos Poisoning of Libby, Montana Uncovered a National Scandal. The book is published by Putnam. And it tells the story of this town in Montana, Libby, Montana, and a mine there where many of the town's residents worked. This past winter, a federal grand jury indicted the mine owner on charges that it hid the fact that ore from the mine was contaminated with asbestos. More than 200 people have died. Many more have developed lung disease as a result of asbestos exposure. This was one reason, the fact that these indictments were handed up a couple of months ago, that we thought it would be worth revisiting the story, also because there is some discussion in the Senate of creating a fund that would pay the claims of people who were injured by asbestos. This is a bill that's co-sponsored by Arlen Specter and by Patrick Leahy. It has come out of committee in the Senate, but has not gone to discussion for the full Senate. And in fact, some people think that because there are a lot of other things, including a Supreme Court vacancy on the Senate's plate, that indeed it may not be discussed by the full Senate this year. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. Questions, as always, are welcome here on the program. The number 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, Andrew Schneider. He has been a journalist for quite a long time. He was Deputy Assistant Managing Editor for Investigations at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, has worked for the Associated Press, for the Scripps Howard News Service, the Pittsburgh Press, and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Right at the moment, he is working for the Baltimore Sun as an investigative reporter. He's won a number of prizes for his writing, including two Pulitzers, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And again, questions are certainly welcome. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, but of course anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Schneider, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks again for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
I certainly appreciate it. For people who did not hear our last conversation or perhaps don't know anything about Libby, Montana, about this story, what I'd like to do is go back and just do a basic review and talk a little bit about Libby. As you spent some time there, you had the opportunity to talk to a number of people there who were affected by the mine there. Maybe we could start, and I'll ask you by talking a little bit about Libby, Montana.
Libby is a small town of a population of about 2,000 in the northwest corner of Montana, just south of the Canadian border. The county, the entire county, Lincoln County, only has 10,000 people. There has been a vermiculite mine in Libby since the early 1800s. Vermiculite is a naturally occurring material that's used for insulation and nursery purposes. And the Libby mine was the largest producer of vermiculite in the world. In 1963, W.R. Grayson's company bought it and increased the production of the mine. This town of Libby is really remote, so any major industry coming to the town is greatly appreciated, and for years the vermiculite mine was the largest employer, followed closely by the timber industry. A good chunk of the town worked at the mine. The town of Libby is in a valley, a gorgeous valley, surrounded by the Cabinet Mountains on three sides. The Kootenai River runs right through it. It's just gorgeous. In fact, that's where the movie A River Runs Through It was filmed. The beauty of the town is one of the reasons, health officials say, that the incidence of asbestos-caused disease and death was so prevalent. Because it's in a valley, there are often air inversions. So the 5,000 pounds of asbestos fibers that were estimated to be pumped out of the processing mill every day, much of it would just sort of hang in the community and would lead to much higher concentrations. I don't know what else I can tell you. Mm-hmm. They're great people, very stoic. They care a great deal about the work ethic. They don't usually get involved in litigation or going after their employers. But over the years, the truth about what W.R. Grace knew about the toxicity of the asbestos contaminating this vermiculite painted a picture of an enormous worldwide corporation that knew exactly the hazard it was bringing on its workers and the community and concealed it.
One of the things that, and certainly we discussed this when we talked last time, was the fact that scientists had known that asbestos was a health hazard and had known that for a long time, that people who worked occupationally with asbestos going back at least to the early 1800s, and in some cases further back than that, it was known that dealing with asbestos was hazardous. When did it become obvious that this vermiculite that was being mined there at Libby had asbestos in it?
Well, David, you're correct. As usual, the history of asbestos being linked to disease goes back to the time of the pharaohs. In fact, it used to be called the slave's disease, as they used to weave asbestos fibers into clothing for burial rites for the dignitaries of that time. By the 1800s, European health specialists were finding disease in workers in factories that used asbestos. Remember, asbestos was called the miracle product. It was used all over the place. There wasn't a movie theater in the United States in the early 1900s that didn't have a large asbestos curtain that sort of moved back and forth. Asbestos, because of its fire retardant ability. So it's been around forever. When did they determine that the vermiculite was linked with asbestos? Probably in the early 50s, before Grace even bought the facility. There were studies that were done by the Bureau of Mines inspector who would go into Libby, go to the mine on a regular basis, and examine the dust and the working conditions, and he would report to management that there was high levels of asbestos. And as we still find today, unfortunately, there are agreements that the mine would let him on as long as he only issued his reports to management. So the workers really didn't know. When Grace bought the mine in the early 60s, it knew what was going on. I mean, the documentation was clearly there.
So in the early 50s, it was known that the vermiculite was contaminated with asbestos. W.R. Grace knew it. Apparently, also, you make the argument in the book that the United States government knew it, and perhaps not that far back, but maybe as early as 1980, the government knew that ore from Libby was contaminated and that the people who worked in the mine and who lived in the town were at risk. Why did nothing happen then?
Well, David, that's a great question. And it's a question that, believe it or not, is still being debated this year in the Senate and in EPA. The book that McCumber and I did, An Air That Kills, we basically did it because there were these handful of government employees from the Denver office who responded to Libby right around Thanksgiving of 99 to sort of discredit this series of stories we ran in the Seattle PI. There was no way in the world they believed that you could have secondary exposure. You could have family members who didn't work in the mine dying of asbestos exposure. So they sort of came up there figuring they had 1 or 2 days' work to discredit this irrational reporter. And now, 7 years later, EPA is still up there. The book talks about these EPA investigators who stood up not only to W.R. Grace and to EPA headquarters, but to the White House as they tried to do their job. About 5 months into their research, somebody stumbled across the reports that you're just talking about, which in fact were done in the late 70s through the 80s. There were three reports. The reports not only talked about the exposure to the workers and the residents around the mine, but to the locations around the country where Grace shipped this contaminated vermiculite. It went to hundreds and hundreds of facilities in at least 40 different states, probably 15 different countries. The raw ore was trucked in or trained in and then put through a heat furnace and popped into this featherweight vermiculite issue. Those EPA studies you're talking about looked at the health issues of these expansion plants that we're talking about and the workers there that were ill and their estimates of how much of this stuff was spewing into the nearby, you know, into the neighbors living around these hundreds of sites. This report just devastated these really dedicated EPA people. They just couldn't quite understand how their organization could have known this and not done anything. And the reason why, nobody knows. It follows a spectrum as absurd as you might imagine. One group of people think because J. Peter Grace, who was then the CEO of the company, was running the Grace Commission for Reagan at the time, all the way through the fact it was just sloppiness and they stuck it on a shelf. Nobody knows, but the truth was out. It was there, well documented.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Andrew Schneider. He's an investigative reporter with the Baltimore Sun and has been a reporter for a long time, worked for a number of other newspapers, including the one in Seattle, the Post-Intelligencer. He is the co-author, along with David McCumber, of the book An Air That Kills, that tells the story of Libby, Montana. The book, originally published by Putnam just earlier this year, came out in paperback, so if you're interested in reading it, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. Questions are also welcome here on the show, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that makes it difficult to track the hazards of asbestos exposure is that it can take some time for the symptoms to develop.
Right.
Clearly, there are some people who have died as a result. Others have been sickened. And in Libby, there are people who got sick simply from living in the town and breathing the air, or who had a family member who worked in the mine. And as you explained, they would come home, either working in the mine or working in the plant where it was processed, they would come home and they would just be covered with the dust, and they would bring it into the home, and they would breathe it, and their wives and their kids would breathe it. So there are a lot of people there that have been exposed, and actually, if we look at the issue of how many people have filed claims here in the United States, we're talking about literally hundreds of thousands of people who have said that they were injured by asbestos exposure. Does anybody have a reliable kind of number about how many people to date have been affected and how that number might grow over time?
Affected by what Grace produced or affected by asbestos itself?
Well, I guess I was thinking about that, but maybe it would be, maybe you would have a better handle on those people who are affected directly by Grace. Maybe also you, I imagine you probably have seen numbers for that larger number that says how many people have just been affected by asbestos.
Let's see. No, nobody knows the numbers, okay? Mm-hmm. They really don't. Mm-hmm. The problem is that for decades, physicians would have patients come in with respiratory problems and their work history put them nowhere near asbestos. So the physicians would never consider an asbestos-related disease. So thousands and thousands of deaths over the decades that were caused by asbestos were often attributed to emphysema, smoking, things that made sense to the doctors. So it's hard to get a number even from death certificates. As the federal government goes around to the sites around the country where Grace processed this, and there's a group called ATSDR, it's the science wing at CDC, at the Centers for Disease Control, and they're eventually going to look at 200 of the plants. They're looking at the first 28 now that process the largest volume, and they can't determine what's there. The plants are closed, but what they have done, at least at the first dozen or two, is tell anyone that lived in that neighborhood, anyone that lived near the plant, anyone that lived with someone who worked at the plant, anyone who delivered uniforms or sold coffee at these facilities around the country, including three or four in Illinois up there, by the way, and two or three in St. Louis, to go see their physicians, to go find someone that understands pulmonary disease and get checked out to see whether or not they have asbestos-related diseases. People don't know, and the issue of where else it goes, it's just hard to say. I mean, for example, ATSDR scientists did as much as their budget would allow and did a quick study of some of these sites. Well, in some areas like Minneapolis and Trenton, New Jersey, local officials are going back and trying to find out a little more about it. And what they're finding is heavy contamination. So we don't know where this is going to wind up, David. You got to add to this... and this deals with Grace, before we go into your broader question, mm-hmm. You've got to add to this that it is estimated that this asbestos-tainted vermiculite is in between 15 million and 35 million homes across the country. Studies have been done, although Grace maintains it is of no health risk. Grace's own studies, as well as studies by the Canadian military, EPA, and other health experts, show you've got this stuff in your attic, and the kids go out there to play, or you go up to get the Christmas decorations, or someone goes in to hang a TV cable, it can generate enough asbestos fiber to be a real health hazard. One of the problems is the EPA has been less than diligent about putting the word out to the public to use care in their own attics. They've got it on their website, but their promises over the years of, putting out a major PR release, letting the public know this hazard might exist in their own homes around the country, has never happened. So the number of people that will be impacted or have been impacted or will be impacted in the future by the material out of Libby is really unknown, but everybody assumes it will grow significantly. Your broader question about how many people around the country are impacted by all asbestos is very political right now. The estimates were that by the middle 90s, it would start diminishing the number of exposures. Just didn't happen. You're dealing with two issues there. You're dealing with less than savory lawyers and physicians who are filing bogus lawsuits. They do medical screening of large groups of people, and if they find any sign whatsoever, regardless of how irrelevant, they'll file suits against any company that ever made this. I need to clarify that we have large numbers of people who were genuinely injured by their employers who concealed the danger, not just Grace, but many other companies. But in addition to that, we have a much larger number of people who have filed bogus suits on behalf of workers who show no sign of disease whatsoever. That's what's led to this asbestos litigation that has been running through the Senate for almost 4 years now.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can talk a little bit more about the indictment of Grace and its employees, and also about some of the discussions have gone on in the Senate about creating a trust fund to pay out payments to people who have been injured by asbestos. We will do that. I have a caller here, and I'd like to get to them so we don't make them wait too much longer. The caller is in Champaign County, here where we are, and line number one.
Hello. Hi. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. One thing I wanted to ask about, is this vermiculite also used in the gardening and nursery industry? Is that another locus of exposure? That's a kind of a little incidental. But the other thing about grace and the cronyism that I think was definitely part of the reason why asbestos is was then suppressed as a problem. We have the situation now where Halliburton under Cheney acquired Desser Industry, which has a big exposure to asbestos liability, and we have a president who one of the few things he said that is sort of environmental in the last State of the Union address was we have to deal with asbestos liability, and that makes me wonder whose liability he's really worried about. So I just think plus ça change, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Well, you want to pick up on that?
Sure. The first question was, is it in potting soils? Yeah, it is, or it was. In fact, the first public report of workers being sickened by the vermiculite occurred in O.M. Scott down in Ohio, one of the biggest manufacturers of potting soil and vermiculite for nursery use. They had 12 or 15 of their workers sickened by this material. That sort of started the government looking at some of this. A really sharp EPA investigator in Seattle, who coincidentally comes from Kankakee, Kevin McDermott and her team started doing studies after we wrote some stories, and they checked lawn products of many different brands and found asbestos in some of them. Scott has stopped using vermiculite, it claims. I'm not sure what else is happening with it. There is one large. Grace still has two vermiculite mines in the Carolinas, and there's a large one in Northern Virginia, a place called Louisa, that is now the largest producer of vermiculite which is also being used in a variety of products. His second question was the relationship between the White House or the White House's interest in asbestos litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your caller has, put his finger on one of the issues that everyone should be considering, regardless of their political bent. This legislation, which was first introduced 4 or 5 years ago, was first called the Asbestos Industry Bailout Bill, because what it did then and what I believe it does now, although I must admit I have not seen the final markup, which came last month, but what it did up till that point was it freed these corporations such as Halliburton. Halliburton had already agreed to pay, I may be off here by a fraction, agreed to pay $4.6 billion in settlements to the employees of the firm it purchased. They'd already adjudicated that. W.R. Grace had already agreed to pay $2.3 billion, I believe, in settlements before it went bankrupt or filed for bankruptcy. All of the other major companies also agreed to pay in the billions. This legislation would free them from paying that. They would no longer have to pay that kind of money, which I think is a real motivation for taking a very hard look at what this does. Is legislation needed to keep bogus suits from being filed in court? Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, but my unofficial off-the-record opinion is, of course, it is clogging up the courts. There is abuse of the system. Many corporations never lied to their workers. In fact, were never told that this stuff was cancer-causing. Perhaps they should have known, but some of them I've gone through many of the court cases. Some of them truly, were not culprits in this. Yet their workers have sued them. many knew and still did nothing. So that's where this legislation stands today. How comprehensive is it? It's not going to protect the people in Libby as it's written now. It's not going to protect the people in Illinois or anywhere else who may come down with asbestos disease because they were playing in their attic, or the people living around the former expansion plants. They're just not going to be covered by this because the asbestos from Libby is a different type than we were used to in the early 1900s that were used in battleships and in boilers in our homes and all. This stuff is extremely toxic, far more toxic. It's called tremolite. It's far more toxic than the traditional chrysotile. So nobody knows what's going to happen.
We are at our midpoint here, and our guest for the hour is Andrew Schneider. He's an investigative reporter with the Baltimore Sun. Has also worked for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Pittsburgh Press, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. He's won a lot of prizes for his work, including two Pulitzers. He's the co-author, along with David McCumber, of a book that is titled An Air That Kills, How the Asbestos Poisoning of Libby, Montana Uncovered a National Scandal. It was originally published by Putnam, and earlier this year came out in paperback. So if you want to read the book, it's out there in the library or the bookstore. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Maybe we should talk at this point just a little bit more about this legislation that is up for discussion in the Senate. At least it's come out of committee. This was the bill that was written by Arlen Specter, co-sponsored by Patrick Leahy, that would create a trust fund, $140 billion to pay asbestos victims. Most of the money would come from the companies that had been sued. Part comes from insurers. A little bit more comes from trust funds that had been set up by companies that have gone bankrupt. And the big catch here is that the victims would be giving up their right to sue. So apparently the idea was to try to provide some compensation to victims and try to provide some protection to the industry. And there are a lot of questions, obviously, and one of the big questions is, will it ever come up for consideration in the full Senate? I think a lot of people feel that it probably won't even happen this year now, in large part because of now they have to deal with the opening on the Supreme Court.
Right. You put your finger on it. The Arlen Specter's committee judiciary is going to be swamped with Supreme Court screenings and the confirmation process should President Bush actually name someone today. That will take care of the rest of the year. But David, frankly, even before this Supreme Court issue arose, there was enormous doubt that this thing would ever fly. The people who pushed for it initially, the insurance companies, you're right, the manufacturers will in fact pay a large chunk of this. Their insurance companies will pay even more. Last month, the insurance companies made it really clear that they were not in favor of the legislation because it doesn't order people not to sue. If people have disease and they're not covered by this, such as the people in Libby, or anybody exposed to tremolite, they can still sue. The insurance companies didn't want that. They wanted a blanket prohibition from anybody going after this. It's fascinating to sort of look at the machinations of this bit of legislation over the last 4 or 5 years. You're right. The current version is Arlen Specter's, but prior to that, Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah was the head of Judiciary, and he worked hard on the legislation. But the medical criteria on this bill was created by a committee formed by the American Bar Association. And if you go back and look at the composition of that committee, three of the eight or nine physicians involved were were connected to the asbestos industry or were expert witnesses in cases about asbestos disease. They just accepted that as sort of a golden rule. Even when you had really professional groups like the American Thoracic Society, which is comprised of the leading pulmonary experts, pulmonary medicine experts in this country, which is where asbestos disease shows, they came out with their own standards. They agonized over 2 years and said this should be the criteria. And the U.S. Senate, Bill Frist and the gang, just chose to ignore it. So, I mean, this is really a quagmire, and I'm not sure when it's going to pass, if it'll ever pass in our lifetime. I mean, clearly something is needed, but, I mean, it's got to be carefully worded. We're not going to be through with asbestos forever, forever. And I tell you why. I'm sitting here this morning working on a story that will probably run on Sunday, dealing with a new study from Harvard and UC Davis talking about naturally occurring asbestos, which is all over the country. There's no villain in this one, okay?
Yeah.
God's doing. It's all over the place. People get this disease. They will get it. They have been getting it. You know, you're not going to rid ourselves of asbestos.
Yeah, in fact, we came across a story. This was from... I guess it's a story about this particular study at UC Davis, and said it was the biggest study ever to look at this issue, and that indeed they found that this stuff was everywhere, was all over the place, so that the risk is much greater than perhaps we had.
Well, realized. I mean, it's good that UC Davis did that, because there is a county in Northern California, El Dorado County, near Sacramento, where the entire county is sort of built on asbestos, on tremolite asbestos, and they build million-dollar homes out there. And when the contractors and the builders cut roads through, it frees this stuff up. It was so bad that they had to, EPA finally did air tests out at the high schools there and found the levels would be highly dangerous. They wound up paving over all the school fields so the asbestos can't get through. I mean, it's all over the country, and until someone disturbs it, it's not going to do any harm. It's when they start building on it, cutting roads through it.
Well, we have another caller to talk with. Why don't we bring them in here, someone here locally in Urbana on our line one. Let's do that. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to, if you could put this into the that sounds you're doing it there, putting the thing into a much bigger picture. But if you'd go back to in the history of litigation and this thing, the first name that came to my mind was Johns Manville Corporation and their role. And also back, I remember many years ago, they had a product that they called rock wool insulation, and that was apparently used all over the place. And I'm wondering, did that have asbestos in it? And in general, what was the role of Johns Manville in the whole asbestos business? And would you compare the type of asbestos that they were producing with this tremolite?
David, I can answer his first two questions, I think. You'll have to repeat the third one because I didn't hear it, okay?
Oh, I think there were just the two. Did we get that call? You want to talk about Johns Manville and its role in asbestos and the question of rock wool insulation, and did that have asbestos?
All right, let's take rock wool first, okay?
Yeah.
Based on scores of contractors and scientists that I've dealt with, traditionally rock wool is like a fiberglass product. It has no asbestos in it. If we're talking about the traditional rock wool insulation, it's a fiberglass-like product spun out of a variety of materials. Even before the fluffy pink stuff we had, many old homes have the yellow rock wool in it, which is not asbestos. This vermiculite in the attic, if you're going up there for some reason, I don't recommend it. But if you do, it's little pieces about the size of your thumbnail, sort of, rectangular or square, metallic in color, you know, little flicks of silver on a pink or brown base. I mean, it's pretty obvious that it's it's not a rock wool event. And there's nothing else out there that looks quite like it. And if you look at EPA's website under epa.gov/asbestos or tremolite, it has photographs of this stuff if you want to take a look at it. Johns Manville was either the first or second major villain to be caught knowingly keeping the dangers of asbestos from its workers and those that used its products. In those cases, you were dealing with victims who truly were ill. There was so much litigation that the company, I believe, went bankrupt, but first set up an enormous trust fund, which many lawyers tell me was adequate to handle those people who were injured because of John Mansfield's activities or product. The third question was what, David?
Well, let me ask the caller. Are we getting it, what you're interested in?
Yeah. What,
oh, I'm sorry.
Was Johns Manville a producer of asbestos? And what was, would you compare the types of asbestos that they were producing to this tremolite?
I can take the first part. John Mansville produced products out of pure asbestos. I mean, asbestos was mined in several areas of the country. California had the last operating asbestos mine, Vermont, several other places. John Mansville also imported an enormous amount of it from Canada. This was chrysotile asbestos, and it was used for thousands of items. Brake shoes, gaskets, oven mitts, ironing board covers, fireproof clothing for firefighters and safety workers. I mean, there were 3,000 to 4,000 products in daily use by consumers that were produced with raw asbestos, and John Mansville at the time was the major producer of that. Your second question, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear it.
Would you compare that type, that type of pure asbestos, to the sort of highly toxic tremolite you were talking about?
Sure.
You said there's a difference.
I can do that for you by citing the work of a Dr. Alan Whitehouse, who is now in Libby working that. He was a pulmonologist, chest specialist working out of Spokane. Dr. Whitehouse had this really unique living laboratory, because the Hanford Reservation, the nuclear reservation, is in Washington State, and they had an enormous amount of the traditional chrysotile asbestos that you were talking about. So half of Allen's patients were exposed to chrysotile. The other half were exposed to tremolite from Libby. I mean, he could and did plot the progression of disease for these two. He's probably had the most unique opportunity in the country to actually do side-by-side comparisons on living and dying patients. I mean, he's done some wonderful reports which the asbestos industry wishes would go away, basically saying that the toxicity of tremolite is far, far greater than chrysotile. Not only that, you talked earlier about the latency period, how long it takes to become ill from asbestos. And with chrysotile, it can be 30, 40 years or more. There are cases in Libby where people in their early 20s, mid-20s, are showing signs of disease because the tremolite is so much more toxic. So there really are major differences. The problem, sir, is that all of the government regulations deal with chrysotile. So when they say, here's a safe limit for chrysotile, it has no bearing on tremolite because it's so much more dangerous. And many of the people in EPA, many of their scientists and physicians, are fighting very hard to get its headquarters in Washington to understand the difference of this stuff. And it's become a political issue, as I'm sure you might imagine.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
The type of disease which is produced by asbestos, as I understand, there's one mesothelioma, which is a kind of a cancer, which is specifically linked only to asbestos, and I presume there are other diseases. Would you describe the types of diseases which
You seem to be very knowledgeable about that, and you're right. Mesothelioma is unique only to asbestos, and that is a cancer of the lining of the lungs, sometimes of the heart, sometimes of the abdomen, and it is a rapidly killing, almost always fatal disease, usually between 6 to 14 months after diagnosed with it, you'll die. Traditionally, the other asbestos diseases are a form of lung cancer that is not quite as lethal, but asbestosis is what most people hear about and most people wind up being subjected to. Mesothelioma was very, very rare, 1 in 2 million or something like that. But now they're finding that's increased. Asbestosis is far, far more prevalent, which basically hardens the lung by growth of tissue to the point where it can't function. Lungs become as hard as an inflated football, and you don't have the ability to breathe. It's a horrible way to die. It can take many, many years to die. It's very costly to try to stay alive with asbestosis. It's estimated that it costs between $400,000 and $600,000 just for the medical care needed to sustain some level of quality of life with asbestosis. It's about $300,000, they tell me, for mesothelioma, only because you die so much more quickly.
Thank you.
Answer your question, I hope?
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Andrew Schneider. He's an investigative reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He has also worked for the Post-Dispatch in St. Louis, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. He's the co-author, along with David McCumber, of the book An Air That Kills. That's all about Libby, Montana, and the health effects of that mine that we have talked about there in Libby. The book's out in paperback now if you want to read it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about this proposal that's been crafted by Erland Specter that may at some point get a hearing by the full Senate that would create a trust fund to pay victims, or at least some victims, of asbestos. And one of the concerns apparently is what if this indeed was enacted, if it became law, what it would mean for states that are dealing with asbestos on the state level. And it's my understanding, from having read a story about this in your paper, that Maryland has a system to deal with asbestos claims, and it's thought to be a very good system, that it's doing a good job. Some people apparently think that it's a model, could be a model for how the process could be handled, and that if a kind of a national trust fund was put into place, would that indeed mean that the system that's there in Maryland would no longer be in operation?
David, that's a great question. And the answer is no one is sure just yet. Will the federal law have primacy over the state law? You're right. Maryland has one of the best systems in the country, as opposed to Madison County in your state that has one of the worst. There are several states like Maryland that has its own docket where the courts will allow someone with signs of the disease to move up the pecking order and get their cases heard much more quickly. I think around the country you're having more and more now getting involved in that. And let me digress just briefly to talk about a judge in Texas who looked at 20,000 cases, 20,000 suits involving silicosis, which is another fiber that comes from mines and quarries. She looked at this and said, I need some time, and I'm told that she had her people spend 3 months looking at these cases. And while I must quickly insert that there are people who die of silicosis, it is lethal. It can be lethal. It can cause something like asbestosis. She found the bulk of those cases appeared to be fraudulent. They were doctors doing bogus medical studies who admitted that they had no idea clinically what silicosis looked like. They had no idea how to test for it. They were just taking
the mass screenings that the lawyers set up with these mobile test units that are so popular with your people down in Madison County, and accepted that as their word. And the judge has thrown the vast majority of that out. I think you're going to have more judges who are conscientious sort of taking a look at some of this. This is where much of your problem lies. There's no doubt that corporations knowingly conceal the dangers to the public and to their workers, but there's equally no doubt that many lawyers and physicians of questionable ethics got on the bandwagon and just found it an easy way to make millions of dollars. And who wind up getting hurt? Those people that really have the disease.
Let's talk with someone here listening in Champaign, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I lived in a really old house in this area. I've since moved, but in the basement, in the ceiling, there were panels that really, to me, appeared to be asbestos-based, and some of them were broken, so, I mean, there must be some particles that were airborne. I was so paranoid that it was asbestos, that I saved a piece. Is there any, if I found out that it did contain asbestos, is there any legal recourse?
I'm not a lawyer, sir. I can't, nor will I, sort of do that. But you said these were like panels hanging between
panels,
the rafters?
They looked like they were asbestos-based.
Yeah, I've never heard of asbestos used. I could be wrong, but I've never heard of asbestos used as paneling between rafters. Usually in residential sites, you find it wrapped around, you know, old boilers and pipes, and, you know, the pipes, white powder falls as this stuff does. But I've never heard it used in sheets.
Sheets?
Constructed that way.
Yeah. So. Isn't it part of floors sometimes? I mean, not that I was concerned about floors, but don't they put asbestos in some floor paneling? Or is that
No, I mean, asbestos is used in asbestos tiles.
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, asbestos tiles, yeah, right.
Yeah, well, they don't. You know, you need to talk to your local health department, but I will tell you in the generality, the only way you're going to get harmed by dealing with asbestos floor tiles or asbestos shingling, which is on thousands of houses in your area, is when you cut it.
Right.
Together, it's safe. You know, when you start hammering it and cutting it, you're losing the fibers. If you had asbestos tiles between the rafters, I don't understand. I can't.
Well, there was like mice that had chewed at certain parts of it, and that's why I was mostly concerned.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Sorry, sir. It doesn't sound like anything that I've ever seen using asbestos as insulation.
Glad to hear
tiles,
that.
Tiles, you've got nothing to worry about.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, let's go here. One more caller. Someone near Kankakee, line number four. Hello.
Yes, sir. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. I got to listen to your presentation here on this asbestos, and it's quite interesting. And the first thing I want to do is apologize to all the EPA that I always thought were going off the deep end with everything. Because it looks like they saved a lot of people. But why not? Can they go after this judge in Texas, go after these lawyers and corporations that ripped off the people that they had something that they didn't have?
That's a great question, you know, and she may do this. I don't know enough about the case.
I just know that
her findings were released this week,
uh-huh.
And I'm not in Texas. I'm in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And the reaction here was, you know, let's build a statue to this woman.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sorry, I missed your name again, please.
Andrew Schneider, Schneider.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're in old farm homes all over, scattered all over the country, every state, I suppose, got asbestos in the basement. And it's interesting. I was telling a neighbor friend about it, too, before I called in. And I suppose that's the same basis that leave it alone.
Yeah, that's always a good idea. Stay out of, you know, if you've got zonalite, which is what they call the insulation from Libby, if you have zonalite insulation in the attic, try to stay out of there. And if you've got the white stuff around your pipes or furnace, wrap plastic around it. Don't mess with it. If you don't mess with it, it won't bother you. The fibers have got to be free, and you've got to inhale them.
We're almost to the point we're going to have to stop, and I do want to ask you real quick, and unfortunately I don't have very much time. Now the indictment that I mentioned, indictment of Grace and some of its employees charged with having known the hazards of the vermiculite and kept that from the public, and also the indictment accused Grace and the former manager of the mine of trying to obstruct efforts by the EPA to investigate the extent of asbestos contamination. What does this all mean now for W.R. Grace?
It's hard to say. This is an amazing suit that EPA and the Justice Department brought. These criminal indictments may be the largest ever, and it took a lot of courage of a lot of people out in the field to bring this, and for people in Washington, in the Justice Department, to sort of let them do it under this atmosphere. So the fact that they've indicted the company and seven of its former presidents or vice presidents is really a big deal. And they indicted them, David, on charges including knowing endangerment, meaning they knew this stuff was bad, they knew this stuff was legal, and they did it. These things carry 15-year penalty per charge or per count, and there are numerous counts if Grace and its people are found guilty.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it for this time around. Mr. Schneider, thanks very much for talking with us again.
Always a pleasure talking to you. Have a good day.
Our guest, Andrew Schneider, he is investigative reporter with the Baltimore Sun, and he is the co-author, along with David McCumber, of the book An Air That Kills, How the Asbestos Poisoning of Libby, Montana Uncovered a National Scandal. The book came out in paperback earlier this year. Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888. We're going to take a break here as we usually do. When we continue with Focus, the next hour we'll talk with Peter Baker and Susan Glasser. They're both reporters for the Washington Post and were for a number of years the bureau chiefs in Moscow for the paper. We'll talk about their new book, Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. First, though, a break for an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit